Radio.
The Politics of the Mass by Dr. Matthew Tan.
So welcome everybody to the second installment of the Theology, Philosophy and the Mass seminar series. And the title for this seminar is called The Politics of the Mass. If you're going to be from Queensland, you probably would be aware that there's going to be a state election coming up this Saturday, and that's only a community announcement. But the relevance to the Mass may seem apparent to many. However, my focus for this seminar is not going to be whether the Mass can tell you who to vote for this Saturday. What I am going to focus on, however, is whether the Mass, according to some of our civic leaders, both liberal and conservative, is to ask whether the Mass has any bearing whatsoever in our public lives. Is there any political dimension in the practices of the Mass that many of our civic leaders, and indeed many Catholics, miss? The short answer is yes. The Mass, more than a process of nurturing individual Christian sanctity, is not only an event that impacts on our political lives, it is also the only truly political act. The Mass is the only truly political act. I should state at the outset that much of what I am presenting today draws heavily from the reflections of an American theologian named William Kavanagh, who wrote a little booklet called Theopolitical Imagination, looking at the Eucharist as a political act in an age of consumerism. It is a book that third years can expect to cover if they decide to study political philosophy, but in the meantime, it is a book that I thoroughly recommend nonetheless. To begin, many might be aware of the popular devotional book, The Pietà. In it, there is one prayer that is written that asks for one for the grace, where one asks for the grace of all of the masses said from the beginning to the end of the world. I believe this is just as much a political statement about the Mass as it is a spiritual one. Now, why is this so? Let us turn to the word that is often used to describe the Mass, which is liturgy. The word comes from the Greek liturgia, which denotes a service that is done at one's expense for the good of the public. The liturgy, first and foremost, is not a personal spiritual massage. I will repeat, the liturgy, first and foremost, is not a personal spiritual massage. It has an unavoidable public dimension. The Anglican theologian Graham Ward once wrote in his book, The Politics of Discipleship, that everything that we do as individuals, including our worship, simultaneously declares our belonging to a particular public body. Right, so to repeat, everything that we do as individuals, including our worship, simultaneously declares our belonging to a public body. The liturgy thus declares to the world, in our practice of the liturgy, we declare to the world the emergence of a particular social formation in its midst. This declaration of a social formation, the polis, is what makes the Mass, the liturgy, an inherently political act. And the social formation that the Mass declares would be a properly understood as a political formation. This is an unavoidable element of the practice of Christian virtue. For as Alistair MacIntyre reminds us, virtue cannot take place without one's belonging to a community of virtue. In the Old Testament, holiness cannot take place without the formation by God of a holy nation. And in the Sermon on the Mount, which is Jesus' completion of the Ten Commandments, that cannot be understood outside the context of his discourses on the kingdom of heaven that preceded. In the same vein, our worship in the Mass cannot be understood outside our simultaneously declaring our belonging to a political formation, one that we profess at every Mass when we recite the Apostles' Creed. I believe in the communion of saints. So the question here to ask is, if the Mass declares a political formation called the communion of saints, who belongs to this communion? Who is in the communion of saints? Who are my contemporaries who participate in the Mass with me? Many Catholics will probably have a sense of the social dimension that comes with the Mass. What may often be overlooked, however, is that they very often confine their contemporaries only to their co-worshippers at any particular Mass. Others may take it even further and actually narrow the scope of their contemporaries only to a particular territory, be it a parish, diocese, or state, which is why you would often hear the Pauline phrase, "We are the Church," interspersed with catch cries like the Sydney Church, or the Queensland Church, or the Toongabi Church, as if those outside such a territory no longer become a contemporary of that worshipper. This becomes then a very short-sighted view of Eucharistic worship. For such territorial notions of the Pauline phrase, "We are the Church," may unwittingly mimic the kind of citizenship in every contemporary nation-state, where one's community and contemporaries are the ones within a single bounded territory to the exclusion of all others. In the face of this kind of civic community building, the Mass becomes what William Kavanagh calls a counter-politics, because the communion of saints is a political formation completely unlike the nation-state on two important levels. First, while citizenship for the modern nation-state is confined to a single territory, citizenship in the Mass implicates a single communion of saints that cuts across the walls of the Church and indeed cuts across the borders of every nation in the world. What brings every saint into this communion is the Eucharistic host, the body of Christ, the body of He who said in the Gospel of John, chapter 12, verse 32, "But when I am lifted up, I will draw all men to myself." When the Mass is celebrated, the communion of saints that is declared is a global communion. So remember this, when the Mass is celebrated, the communion of saints that is declared is a global communion. This is one element of the Catholicity of the Catholic Church. And in the early Church, this Catholicity was often expressed in the Mass by the presence of bishops of two dioceses at a single Eucharistic celebration. This Catholicity is expressed in the nature of the Eucharistic host itself. For in every Mass celebrated in the world, each Eucharistic host is not a mere fragment of the body of Christ. It's not as if that you are receiving at communion only Jesus' finger, ear, or toe, or appendix. No, in every Eucharistic host that you receive the one, single, whole body of Christ. And the many Eucharistic hosts that you see at Mass become agents of a unity brought about by the one single body of Christ. Every recipient of the Eucharistic host, regardless of their geographical location, is thus turned into a citizen of a single communion, because their reception of the Eucharistic host enfolds them into that single Eucharistic body. It was this conception of global unity that made the political philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau regard the unity of the Church as, quote, "so obviously baneful," unquote. For such a global unity, Rousseau argued, threatened the unity of the state. But the unity brought about by the communion of saints cuts across more than just space, because the celebration of the Mass implicates a political union that cuts across time as well as space. You get a sense of this when the presbyter in the first Eucharistic prayer asks God to command his angels to receive the sacrifice in this earthly altar and join it with the sacrifice in this altar in heaven. Where the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 4, verse 8, reminds us, in this altar in heaven, Christ the high priest is offering an eternal sacrifice to God. But the reference to heaven is not just merely to be understood as another place, but to a time. In chapter 12, verse 22 of the letter to the Hebrews, the author to the letter refers to the Mass as entering, quote, "a heavenly Jerusalem," which reminds us of the Jerusalem adorned like a bride, which comes at the closing of the present age in the book of the Apocalypse. The Mass is thus an eschatological moment Whenever you go to Mass, you are celebrating the end of time. And by implication, the communion of saints that participate in this Mass are part of a body of Christ at every point in history, up to our arrival at the heavenly Jerusalem in the world to come. Now, what does this mean for our sense of who our contemporaries are in the Mass? What does it do to that question? In the first place, it makes the communion of saints, quote, a democracy of the dead, as G.K. Chesterton once put it. Our contemporaries are those who have participated in all of the Masses past, whether that Mass was held 2, 20, or even 2,000 years ago. Why is this the case? Because they have received the same single body of Christ then as we are receiving now. At the same time, the Mass also incorporates those who would become citizens in the future. Our contemporaries are also those who would receive that same single body of Christ in Masses still to come. Our contemporaries are then, to quote Psalm 78, will include those, quote, a generation not yet born, unquote. The Eucharistic polis, then, is not comprised of what G.K. Chesterton once called, quote, the proud and arrogant oligarchy of those who just so happen to be walking about, unquote. Because the body of Christ incorporates citizens of the past, of the present, and of the future. Now, as before, this is not just a nice mental exercise. If the above reflections are correct, and if our fellow citizens of the body of Christ include those in the past as well as in the future, this Eucharistic notion of citizenship would have a number of important implications for our belonging in any nation state. Two important implications will be mentioned. Three will be mentioned. First, whilst we cannot avoid our civic belonging, we cannot also avoid the realization that this very often sits in tension with another form of citizenship, our citizenship in the body of Christ. And the Christian cannot allow that civic belonging to trump our Eucharistic citizenship, often by narrowing the scope of who constitutes their fellow citizen in the nation state. As William Kavanagh reminds us, the nation state has a very powerful influence on our sense of belonging, confining our fellow citizens in the city of man to merely those who are alive with us. Chesterton's arrogant oligarchy of those who just so happen to be walking about. Our secular sovereigns would have us believe that we owe our duty to our fellow citizens, but only in this very narrow sense. In so doing, the civic body, in the name of unity, often breaks the unity of the Eucharistic body by turning three sets of Eucharistic fellow citizens into outsiders. First, we are made to forget our solidarity with Eucharistic citizens beyond our immediate civic borders. We are forced to shrink the global extent of the body of Christ to only those within the civic border, within the nation state. Second, we are made to forget our solidarity with Eucharistic citizens of the past through our forgetting of tradition. Thus, the redefinition of many traditional institutions by the civic body are not just undermining old understandings in the name of the majority of that arrogant oligarchy. Only in the light of the unity of the Eucharist can you also understand that such redefinitions of traditional institutions also weakens the ties that link us to our fellow citizens of the Eucharist in the past. And third, our civic belonging will also have us forget that our future Eucharistic fellows, by making clear demarcations on who is an outcast even within the borders of the civic body. And thus, these outsiders are unworthy of our compassion or assistance. The Eucharistic citizen, on the other hand, cannot say that any person can truly be an outsider, because from the standpoint of the Mass at the heavenly Jerusalem, anyone could potentially be a fellow Eucharistic citizen. This is why Mother Teresa was able to link daily Eucharistic adoration with the help of the poor. Adoration was not just an individualistic aid to help the individual's burden that comes with the helping of non-Christian poor. Rather, Eucharistic adoration was an aid to see Christ in what would be a Eucharistic citizen in the future, to see Christ in the poor. This seems to put a new spin on the attention that Jesus asked to that we give to, quote, the least of my brethren. Our brethren may not necessarily be the least in terms of wealth or health. They may be least also in terms of the possibility of becoming a brother in the Eucharistic body. To conclude, in our Eucharistic worship, the Christian cannot but be made aware of his simultaneous civic and Eucharistic belonging. The city of man, embodied in the nation state, will always try to lay the superior claim over us and trump our other belonging in the city of God, manifest in the communion of saints, manifest in the body of Christ. But our participation in the Mass, because it takes place in heaven at the end of our present age, will make a single people of recipients of the Eucharistic host in every age, as the old English translation of the third Eucharistic prayer makes clear. From age to age, you gather a people to yourself. In light of this, we cannot be sure whether anybody who walks in our midst is not a fellow Eucharistic citizen. And so we cannot be sure if we should heed the calls of our secular sovereign to abide by its notion of unity, one that is ready to brand anyone, Christian or non-Christian, as a non-citizen and thus an outcast. Our decision to brand someone as an outcast in our day may have an impact on us on the day of judgment, when Jesus would ask us if we have neglected the least of my brethren. I thank you for your attention.
Ticks of the Mass. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.